Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Right, we're off. Miles Keane, hello.
Hello.
Good morning. I was saying good morning, but of course that's stupid because it's don't know when this is going to go out. So, whatever. Good day, I suppose.
Thank you.
Welcome to Just Not Good Enough, which is I like to call it a radio show, but it's probably more of a podcast, actually. But that's too modern. I'm a bit old-fashioned in that sense. All to do with mental health in business. And your story is quite well talked about, isn't it, online and yourself, and you do all sorts of talks. But rather than me introduce you, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay. So, hello, everyone. Miles Keane. I'm at present an executive director at Coutts, and I work with UK-based entrepreneurs. So I lend money, I invest money, I look after them, I do their banking and everything else. But for quite a period of time, I was running the wellbeing initiatives within Coutts and company, and that led to quite a big part of my role expanding on that area and helping the main group, which was at the time RBS and then became NatWest. But then, you know, there were lots of things that I learned that people were finding really helpful. So a big part of what I do is go out and try and spread the news, share the love, and you know, give some of the stuff that really helped me, and just see if it might help the odd person.
Yeah, because we're going to come onto it in a bit, I'm sure, about the period around the financial crisis in the late tens. Is it the late tens? No, it's late noughties.
Late noughties.
But I'd like to start. Just you went to university at Cardiff.
Yes.
Economics.
No, I did geography and geology.
Fair enough. Yeah. And then banking. Well, how did that work?
So I was always good with numbers, and I like people. I mean, I love my degree, geography and geology.
I wish I'd done that.
It wasn't quite the career for me. A lot of rock observations and things.
About to say something very similar.
Not many people. So I can tell you what most of the sort of the tops of all the sort of in the banking halls, you know, there's lots of sort of granite and stuff.
Course,
and
I could
talk to the cows come home on that one. But I got a job with Lloyds Bank, and then in the interim I had a sales job with Yellow Pages, which was really interesting actually, because I was talking to entrepreneurs, which is what I do now, and asking them how they make their money. I was always sort of, I guess, people orientated, but always liked my numbers. And so I had
it's a good combination,
10 years with Lloyds, which I really enjoyed actually.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
And then it was time for a change, and I joined Coutts, and have had been there 23 years. I've had a fabulous time there.
Yeah, you've obviously enjoyed it because you've been there a long time. I mean, getting into Coutts is difficult though, isn't it? Because it's such a niche bank.
From what perspective? A client or a worker?
I can only know it from a client because I've never worked there, but I guess it could be a bit of both, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a natural progression for me, and it was quite a jump. I always liken it as going from sort of kindergarten straight into university.
Oh.
Because the value and complexity of the client was significantly higher than what I was used to. But it was a lovely transition. And I just love working with entrepreneurs. I mean, they make the world go round.
Yeah, we're going to talk about those as well, because I think they're a special breed, aren't they?
But for a client, I mean, there are criteria. Sort of, it's usually sort of a million of investments under management.
I was going to ask you that, but so that's that. Then.
That's a sort of the broad.
Well, thanks for coming in. It's been my invite to Coutts has just suddenly gone out the window. Carry on.
I don't know where we were.
No, I don't either. No, I don't. We're talking about Coutts and the because I was thinking it's quite niche, but it's because you have niche customers. Presumably, then the staff are niche and the culture. Is niche.
Yeah, it's a really interesting culture. I mean, it's been fantastic. I mean, it's such a people relationship orientated business. I mean, I've had clients that I've looked at since I've started there. So you really, that's what I really like, getting to really know your clients very well, really getting into their world, understanding it. And I mean, it's a very privileged position because, you know, people really open up about things because
Trust you, don't they?
Yeah, it's all about trust.
Yeah.
But when you think of it, a lot of them have made vast sums of sort of wealth, and often the networks they it's not always appropriate for them to talk about it. But of course, when you've got an independent banker who's sort of not part of their immediate setup, although you become very close to them over a period of time, it's amazing how much they open up. But the more we know and the more they know about me, the better it is and easier it is to do business.
Yeah. Do you always give them financial advice. Does that ever go further to, lifestyle advice or whatever?
One of the things I always talk to new clients about when I don't know someone, and I say this to the junior staff because they've kind of made it, and you tell the story and it sounds really easy and it's happened quickly, but of course it's happened over a number of years.
Yeah.
And I always like to ask them about, what were the real oh shit moments and, what were the real pinch points in your journey? Now, I've been really public about what happened to me, and it often comes up in conversation. And it's, the stats speak for themselves. One in four will have a mental health disorder at some stage. Yeah. And it's
is
probably
that entrepreneurs? Because I didn't
no,
read
I think
that
that's
some,
just general.
That's general,
but
isn't
I,
it?
I've heard one in four don't. It could be three in four because everyone's affected by it. If someone has been through it, there's always someone around them who are affected by it because they've got the support network and everything else.
Yeah.
But it's a, it's just a really opening, a really good way to open up the conversation and really understand your clients. Because I think the more you know about them and understand, the better you're in a position to give them the advice.
That's new though, isn't it? New-ish, I'd say. This talking about these sorts of things in work and in business, because I occasionally use the analogy of, a social movement, if you want to call it that, takes ages to do anything. So, you think of civil rights in America, the gay rights, the LGBT, that's been going for decades, and we're just about getting to the point where it's okay.
We're sort of
at the early stages of this, aren't we?
Yeah, well, depends where you are. I mean, for me, when I was first ill, it just wasn't talked about. And part of my journey and actually getting better and realizing just how many people in the workplace suffer, I needed to stick my head above the parapet and get it out there. That was, I had a sort of few mentors over time, and I was chatting with a lawyer friend of mine, and I told him the story, and he said, you should be getting this out there. It's a really powerful story. Not only, it's not about me, but it's more about the kind of the journey and then the output at the end, because I came very close to not being here.
Yeah.
And that was terrifying. And when I look at myself as I, pretty level-headed, logical sort of guy, to get to that point where it could have all ended, to then think where I am now. And, I know anyone who's got a mental health disorder, there's always a way out and you can get better.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't want to talk about it,
exactly,
do they? Because it's well known, the stigma, fear of being weak, losing your career, your livelihood, your mortgage, everything is at risk.
Yeah.
Really.
Well, I was in that boat, so it wasn't talked about. And I guess I had, my mum coming from Ireland, and it was very, she's fantastic, but it was a real stiff upper lip, you can never talk about this sort of thing.
That's a generational thing, though, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Because my parents were the same.
Absolutely, but it's so important to talk about it. And what I found as soon as it was out there, it was, I'll never forget when it first launched. So when I'd got better, and when we got going on a wellbeing strategy, and I just stood up, we have a briefing every Wednesday. There was a couple of hundred people in the room. There was a big one because it was our staff charity was in, which was all about care. And I just gave a snippet. I said, look, there's some stuff going to be coming up that we're going to launch about wellbeing. This is why I got involved. And in about 2 or 3 minutes, I gave a very brief synopsis. And it was as if the whole room had just exploded. The reaction was unbelievable. And I think by the end of the day, I'd had over 100 emails, either saying, fantastic, great to stand up and get this out there. But it was the quiet ones from the people that were just saying, thank God someone has actually stood up and publicly said, it's okay to talk. And, that was, I knew then whatever we were going to do was going to work.
Yeah, because it's. Let's go back a little bit, because I'd like to just understand your journey leading up to the 7 and 8 financial crisis.
Yep.
And did you get any inkling that things were not going particularly well, or was this just a, you know, daily stress of life, you know, at work? I don't know if you've got family, but, you know, da 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 da. And yeah. Just you're thinking, well, you know, this is the way it is.
Yeah. So it's an interesting question. So I've always been a pretty happy-go-lucky chap. There's been a bit of, you know, mental health within the family. So I know it can be genetic at times. But mine was very much work-related and environment-related.
So nothing before?
No, not
what
really.
About
a couple
Lloyds?
Of times.
At Lloyds?
No, that was all fine.
No indication, right?
Whenever there's been really big change, I remember changing jobs when I first went. So I was at Lloyds for 10 years. I went into private banking after about 5 years.
At Lloyds.
At Lloyds, I got right. quite a senior job, and I had a guy who was my mentor that was, you know. I think he had the hump that I'd got such a high promotion. And the mentor,
I thought you were going to say something different.
He was setting me sort of almost traps, and it was a terrible experience. But I got my way through it, and it was a time I'd just become a father. So there's a lot going on. And I remember at that time, when I look back, have I ever had sort of challenging times? So, yeah, that was quite difficult because I had a new job with a big promotion and zero support from this particular individual.
Somebody's
so I had
trying
to
undermine you.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'll never forget
Isn't
it.
Isn't that behaviour appalling?
Yeah.
Anyway, all right, we're going to come back to that, I'm sure, as well.
So it was quite interesting, though, because a couple of years later, the CV landed of that person at Coutts, and the head of HR phoned me up, and it wasn't a very long conversation.
How did you feel?
What goes around
How did
comes
that
around.
Get to you?
Well, I was just very honest about things.
Excellent.
So, you know,
excellent.
You can't go too
yeah,
far.
Yeah, but if they behave like that.
Oh, 100%.
They deserve it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry, but.
Oh, no, you know, absolutely.
Countercultural,
yeah,
for God's sake.
Yeah, cultures, you know. That's why I've loved working at Coutts. It's a really great place.
Yeah,
great
it is.
People.
It does sound. So we're just leaving Lloyds, going to
so
Coutts.
Where it started when I pinpointed it back, and this was quite a long time afterwards that I did this. But there was a big business course that we did at our swanky sort of RBS head office in Gogaburn, and they flew in all sorts of speakers. I think Kate Adie was there, but there was a New York professor. This was 2007. October 2007,
right, okay.
A year before the financial crisis, and this New York professor, well, they were talking about sort of things that could disrupt the world and black swans and things like that, but she talked about the subprime crisis that wasn't really known at the time.
No.
And frightened the life out of us, because she said this
type of thing... When you say us, do you mean you personally or just...
The audience.
The audience, right.
And it was... Because everything she said actually happened, and it was all around all these ridiculous loans that were going out in America without, you know, any repayments, and they were all being sliced and diced and packaged up and insured by AIG,
yeah.
And there
yeah.
were these AAA bonds, aren't they great? And it was, you know,
bucket
of rubbish, basically.
AAA, yeah.
So, and I just remember thinking, oh my word, you know, that's pretty scary, because we were advising on clients,
yeah.
And they're in business and everything else, and I could just sort of see this coming, and it came in spades a year later. So I look back to that point. What really tipped me over?
But was there any sign?
No, not then. I think
it's almost that conference then, was it?
That was the initial thing. When I look back, that was the first, because I ended up developing quite a severe anxiety disorder,
yeah.
Generalized anxiety disorder, which again took sort of 3 or 4 years to diagnose. And I think that's where it started, because you get these sort of seeds of doubt that creep in your head, and that was always at the back of my mind. So I always thought, ooh, we're in for a rough time. And it must have just been like a dormant virus.
Yeah.
And then when the going really got tough, that really spiked up. And what happened was Bear Stearns had gone bust. The city was really quite nervous. And I'm looking after some of the top entrepreneurs in the country. And they're very, very successful people. And they were, you know, the conversations I had. I mean, there was one lending course. It was just before they all got, all the CEOs of the banks got called into Downing Street when the world was literally blowing up. And I came back from a course. I had all these phone calls to make, because obviously word had got out that, you know, potentially RBS were in trouble and, you know, all their money's with us. We were in, you know, Coutts are part of RBS and everything else. And these were highly successful, rational people talking about stockpiling cash, gold, food, improving security, in some cases arming themselves, because they just thought this could all go pear-shaped and there'll be anarchy. And, you know, when you look back, Alistair Darling who was Chancellor at the time, you know, all his memoirs, you know, there were van loads of cash being driven up motorways ready to fill cash points if there was a run on the bank, because there'd been a run on a bank a year earlier. So all of that was going on.
Was it owned by the government at that point?
No.
Right,
no.
Okay.
So we were literally at the epicentre of what was going on.
Yeah.
And I remember going home that night, because banks were, you know, estate agents of the time, there's always someone that the public are really against. And, you know, I kind of got it. But I picked up the Standard and there was a big article about, oh, we could see bankers being dragged from their home in Lynch. It was just sort of, one of those sort of...
I don't know why I'm laughing.
No, I know, but it was quite, you know, yeah. And of course I was in that sort of unknown, serious anxiety mode. And to cut a long story short, I didn't sleep for 3 weeks. And
you see, I read that. I find that was staggering.
I've just, head was racing, spinning, just didn't... Yeah, it was terrifying.
You can't function.
You basically lose cognition.
Yeah.
So I went mad, and that's when you know, I think there's a tipping point with the chemicals in your brain, and once it's gone, you seriously need medical intervention.
Yeah.
And it got to that point, there was a trigger. It was on a Monday, about 3 weeks later, something had happened at work, something pretty minor.
Yeah, trivial.
Can't even remember it. It triggered me. And I said to the team lead at the time, I'm not feeling very well, I want to go home. And I was thinking about throwing myself under a train and all this. It was terrifying. Got home about 11 o'clock, and my wife, she was at home at the time because she took a career break. It's a bit strange seeing Miles come home at 11 o'clock, and I literally got in the house and just capitulated. I was screaming and howling, and I was in an uncontrollable state. And she took me straight to the GP.
Good on her.
Within about 2 hours, I was sat in front of Dr. Islam, who was the head medical guy at the Priory in Roehampton. And I'll never forget this conversation because, tell me what happened. And I was saying, about the whole journey and, the all subprime and everything. And I think it was the first time I sort of raised a smile because he said, oh, is my pension fund going to be all right? And it was sort of a little bit tongue-in-cheek. Obviously, he listened to this. Oh, my God, what's going on here? And it was, it's very, very real. So I had quite a sort of... It wasn't like, oh, I'm dreaming up stuff. This was kind of real at the time. It was absolutely terrifying. And of course, government stepped in, underwrote everything and solved it all. I guess we're all paying a bit for it now.
Yeah,
but there was so much press, so much conversation. My wife went, we had a dog at the time. She was in Richmond Park. She overheard these two people talking, oh, my God, it's going to be anarchy and all that. So it was quite real. But I just... absolutely capitulated. Hit
so
the wall.
Did you blank it all, or did you take it even more on board?
It was like classic Atlas. I had the world on my shoulders.
Yeah.
And I couldn't talk to. I didn't feel. I don't know. I just sort of panicked, I guess, and just it was all wrapped up in my head, and just collapsed. And luckily, I didn't do anything daft. But what was interesting? So basically, they put me to sleep for a week, fed me. So I was on no idea what, but some pretty heavy drugs.
That sounds quite attractive, actually.
Yeah. I woke up about 4 or 5 days later. I thought, because I'd slept and I felt so much better.
Well, having gone 3 weeks not sleeping, is that, was it at the end of that period?
They just said, right, you're out of town now.
Yeah.
So they zonked me out, fed me, woke me up, fed me. And then about 5 days later, I sort of, blimey, where on earth am I? Can't even remember going in or anything. And then I was in there for about 3 weeks, and there's loads of fitness stuff. There was a lot on cognitive behavior therapy. But to be honest, my head was mush. I didn't really take anything in. The biggest mistake I made, though, was going back. I was so, I've got to go back to work. And I went back after about 5 weeks. I just wasn't ready. But interestingly, I sort of bounced back quite quickly. So whatever I had, it was a really steep, deep decline and then quite a big, I think a major deal that I'd been working on landed when I was in hospital and kind of made me look a bit of a hero. And I sort of bounced back and carried on as if nothing happened. At work, they were so kept it quiet. and I just sort of bounced back and carried on. And it
so
was.
Did you hide behind your outward persona?
A little bit, yeah. So I didn't really tell people at work. A couple of people knew. Obviously, the family all knew, and I sort of phased back in. But I was sort of back within about 5 weeks. Very good boss at the time, but he said, "Look, let's all keep this under the radar. Let's, you know, not tell HR and stuff."
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's a shame. Well, looking at it now, that he did that.
So basically, I cracked on for 3 years. And did well, got promotion. When I look back, it was probably too early.
So 3 years?
Yeah, so I had a three-year period where it was all going swimmingly well.
Were you on medication or anything like that?
I was for a bit and came off it.
Okay, did you change your lifestyle? Did you do anything?
No, this was the problem. I didn't really change anything.
Okay.
And, of course, if you don't change anything, something's going to happen again. Yeah. There was another really big period of change. So loads of new regulation came in, the thing called the Mortgage Market Review and the Retail Distribution Review. So all the roles at Coutts completely changed. And I ended up in a role that I wasn't really suited to. It was all new. It was awful time for everyone, not at Coutts. It was a load of change going on. And I think it was, when I look back, it's big periods of change can often trigger me off a little bit. So to cut a long story short, I went into a deep decline again quite quickly.
Same as before?
As before. But what was terrifying is the world wasn't ending. Because at the time, global financial crisis, that was huge news.
So this was about you.
Yeah. And I remember I was back in the Priory, and I remember picking up again. I shouldn't read the Standard, but there was an article about if you've had mental health once and you get it again, you know, the implication was you're screwed. And I was...
Screwed in what sense?
As in...
career.
Yeah. Right. And I remember sitting in the Priory, I've got three kids, a mortgage, thinking I'm never going to work again.
Yeah.
And it was terrifying. So it felt worse that time because I thought, the world, this is about me. And the only person I ever named that I saw in the Priory, because he's been very public about it, is that he was the CEO of Lloyd's, Antonio Soria, who's done fantastic stuff in mental health space.
Yeah.
And he, you know, I remember looking at him thinking, oh, my goodness, you just look wrecked, you know. Because he had a similar thing. It was exhaustion. He hadn't slept.
And,
we had the same consultant. So it was interesting. Contact.
There's something about banking, isn't there?
It could have been.
Sorry, but, I shouldn't make jokes.
No. It was, I think financial services is at times very stressful.
Well, I had a guy industry. On last time, actually, with he was in financial services, and he's, you know, he had periods where he was pretty awful.
But no one in finance services talks about it.
Don't. It's because it's a macho culture environment, you know, and it's the pictures you see in films and on the telly and all this sort of stuff, you know, and the old days of the stock exchange with the people running around shouting and throwing tickets at each other, you know, and so on. It's that is the culture that people think it is.
But I made the mistake again of going back to work quite early. So it was that, I think I'll never work again, must get back. And I remember when I went back, there'd been quite a big change in the management, and I met my new guy, really nice guy, and I said, I need some time with you. And I started telling him the story, and he said, you don't need to tell me this. And he was sort of doing it from a protectionist point of view for me.
Helping, right.
Yeah, okay. Saying, we don't sort of want this noted down, and or whatever, you know, it was just one, and I said, no, I need to tell you this, because I haven't been well. And so I got back to work, and I soldiered on for a year, and I you know, this thing called presenteeism, you have to be there, and it's fear of not being in, and I was...
But you're completely ineffective when you're there.
Yeah, I reckon I was like -1, because it took someone to sort of check out what I was doing and everything else. So I had, it was a terrible year. And I just...
When's this, 2012-ish?
No, 2011.
11, okay.
So 3 years on, it was the second time I've been in the Priory, came back, awful. And I soldiered on for a year and then hit the wall again, but I didn't want to throw myself under a train. I said, I'm out of here. This isn't working. I don't know what to do. but I'm going to take some time out. And I said, you need to have a think about what I can do here, and I need to have a think about what I can do here, but I'm out. And I didn't go...
That was very well ahead of your time, wasn't it? Because that was before any of this sort of really hit the headlines.
Oh, yeah. Oh, massively, yeah. And this was the thing, and it still hadn't hit the headlines, because Antonio Hurtado-Soro, I think he was quite instrumental, I think, because he was a really high-profile person.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of good things. And what happened then, I got referred to occupational health. So
you said that as if that was...
I say that because it kind of was. No, it was the best thing that happened.
Ah, okay.
Because, I mean, in the day, occupational health and mental health disorders, you know, there's a white van, you ain't coming back sort of thing. That was the perception of it. Whereas actually, this, so bearing in mind I've been in the Priory, and the criticism there, because look, at the end of the day, they saved my life, but I didn't really get better. There was a couple of things that I remembered really well, and they tried, but they didn't really get to the heart of it. And they basically were a highly leveraged buyout, needed bums on seats, and so they just, you know, keep you in there and all this sort of thing. And I got, you know, I thought... So I was surprised I wasn't diagnosed with a generalised anxiety disorder, whereas the occupational health guy got it within about 10 minutes. My wife was in the meeting with me. I said what I've got. And he said, you ever seen Toy Story? I said, yeah. And he said, remember the code red man? Something kicked off and it would code red and it was all panic alarms and blowing everything out of proportion. He said, look, you get something in your head that's a problem and you blow it out of proportion and you catastrophize and you get to a point where it just, you know, invalidates your head. You sort of shut down.
You get a single thought,
yeah,
and it just absorbs everything. It fills your whole headspace with that one thought, because that's what happens to me.
Yeah, and he said that's what's generalized anxiety disorder. I said that's it exactly. So I said, what have I got to do? He said, well, you need to go and see an anxiety specialist. I'm thinking, you know, why hasn't that happened till now?
Is it, yeah, well, interesting, yeah. And it's an occupational health guy as well who's doing it. Are you focused on what could happen or what is happening? When you're having your anxiety periods.
The outcome.
It's what could happen.
Yeah, because thoughts aren't facts, are they? So,
No, but you could be thinking about the past. About something that you've done or something that you've happened about or something that is this situation, I'm not getting on with that person or whatever. Yeah. So there's sort of three, you know, past, present, future. But you're more about...
worrying about what could happen.
Right, okay.
And panicking, maybe panicking about something that has happened in the past that, I don't know. But it was more around, oh, God, there's a problem. Oh, my God, this is going to happen. That's going to mean that.
Yeah.
You know, lose your job out in the street, that sort of thing. That's where I went. So I went to see, I got a referral, a guy called Blake Stovey, London Psychology Clinic. He is one of the best in the world at anxiety disorders. And I had about six or seven sessions with him. So the first one was like a massive fact find, loads of questions. Boom, boom, boom. And he said, right, I'm going to give you homework and everything. But he taught me all about cognitive behavior therapy. And there was one guy at the Priory who was very good. There was a coin analogy. It was all about being in the moment. I always thought, what's all that about?
Yeah.
And it was the side of the coin. How many sides of a coin? Most people say two. You've got, you know, the two big sides and then the little thin strip. And he said, well, there's actually 3 miles. And your problem is you're never on the thin side, which is the present. So one side is past, one side is future.
Yeah.
You're never in the present because you're always... worrying about something that happened last week, or you're trying to sort something.
Yeah, well, you flip a coin, it never lands on there.
Yeah,
well, but it probably does, but occasionally.
But his point was, you can only ever do something now.
Yes.
You're not spending any time now. So that was a defining moment. And when I put together a presentation, which we designed a load of in-house training and we've taken it all over the place, but I show this the coin, and then this, and then I said, "Well, I've become a stick of rock," and I said, "It's not a macho hard stick of rock. It's basically look at the shape of a stick of rock. It's got a massive long edge and two little round bits at the end, and those round bits for me are now past and future, because I now spend all my time in the moment. That's when you can do stuff.
Yeah,
and that was a seismic shift for me. One of the things that I remembered really well, and of course, Blake Stobie got me on the cognitive behavior therapy. A lot of it was grounding yourself and being in the moment.
Yeah,
and gave me all these really useful metrics and techniques that have now become part of me, and just, I don't, you know, they're intuitive now.
Isn't there a danger, though, with these things, that you learn a new technique, you try, it's like a New Year's resolution, mm-hmm. you try it for 2 weeks, and I think it was the 15th of January, every New Year's resolution pretty much has been given up, you know, and you start out with good intentions, you always try and do more than you're capable of doing, and you push yourself too far, and then it becomes a chore. So how did you get to the point where it's suddenly a habit?
So and it has to become a habit. That's the thing, because, you know, it's like diets. You know, people go on these crash diets and then they lose a load of weight.
And yeah, and before you know it, they're twice as heavy,
So I knew, and this is a really important point, because I did the same stuff. If you do the same stuff in life, the same things happen. I knew I had to change, and I did. So it wasn't changing me, it was changing what I do, so behaviour change. So some of the metrics, so when I got a problem, I had the best case, worst case, most likely scenario type of thing. I always used to go code red. So he used to say to me, if you've got a problem, you know, tell me about the problem. And I'd explain it. And he said, well, where are you on it? And I was always sort of 10. And he said, right, what we've got to do is get you a good thinking mechanism to kind of bring you down to reality, because they're not all tens. And the first thing was to ask two questions. So, you know, let's say my 10 was going to end up losing my job. And he said, are you really going to lose? Think about it, Miles. Are you really going to lose your job over this? And the answer was always no. And then the second one was, you know, has this happened before? No. So, well, if the first thing that's happened, if you're thrown out your job for that, it's not a great place to work, is it?
Yeah.
So, but it was a real... Okay, two simple questions got me to an 8.
But didn't you question the questions, if I can put it like that, by saying, all I'm doing is answering it because I know that's what he wants me to say? Did you genuinely believe it?
Oh, yeah, because when you think of it, oh, God, I could have done a job with it. You know, that's where your mind goes. You know, it was a regulatory issue or something like that. And, you know, oh, my God, you know, disaster. And he just asked that question, Miles, are you really going to lose your job over this? I want you to think about that, anchor that point. And you go, no. So what he got me to a new, where's your, you know, with those two questions, where are you now out of 10? It was kind of 8. And then he said,
that's good, isn't it? That's good.
Yeah. And then let's really turn it round. He said, look, what is the worst case scenario? And I explained, so from a regulatory point of view, because everything we do is regulated, you know, it would have been, you'd temporarily lose your license, we'll take you off the road. So what happens when they take you off the road? Well, they put someone with you to get you back on the road. So you have extra training, a load of support. It's not great, but actually they're going to throw a load of support at you because they want you back on the road because you're, you know, an income earner and boom, boom, boom. So he said, that sounds pretty good. You know, if you really make a horlicks of something, they're going to throw a load of training at you, help you get better so that you can do your job again. So that's pretty good. And then he said, what's the best case scenario? And it was, but this particular issue, I appeal all of the things that they said I've done and overcome it. And, you know, I get a gold badge for being good or whatever. And he said, so where's that now out of 10? I said, well, it's 1. And he said, what's the likelihood of that happening? I said, probably 0.
Yeah.
But he said, doesn't matter. So what I want you to do when you get a humdinging problem is test it to get your worst case scenario and then have a think about what the best outcome could possibly be. But then you spend your time examining what will probably happen. And then you go through each thing. And the whole idea was taking you out of dream world about, oh my God, it's going to be a disaster, to actually being very practical, measured, thinking it through properly, spending time on it, so that you then ultimately have a list of things you've got to do to sort the problem out. And you do that because you're in the moment thinking about it rather than panicking and being irrational.
There's quite a logical process to this, isn't there? And I just wonder whether going through the logical process, you still get the emotional buy-in at the same time. Because that, I see, for me, that's the thing that really makes a difference. Because I can talk to myself and say, don't do this, don't be so stupid, don't think about this. But actually, deep in my heart, I'm still thinking, this is a problem.
Yeah.
So how did you get to the point where emotionally you were?
So that's a really good point. So one of the things at the Priory, and it's in quite a few of the books, there's a book called Depressive Illness, Dr. Tim Cantor. Curse of the Strong, it's called.
Ah, you know, I've written that down in my notes because I wanted to bring it up.
There's a slide in there, and this was another. You get there are a few key moments, and one of the most impactful pages I've ever seen in a book was these thinking errors. So you've probably heard of things like black and white thinking. So catastrophizing would be a great one, making a mountain out of a molehill. Another one was negative filtering. So there's a picture of someone's head with a filter and all the pluses. You're taking all the positive stuff out. Black and white thinking. And this was the point. So I was code red. I got the new worst case scenario, which became black. The best case scenario was white. But grey. So grey is my favourite colour because there's so many shades of grey.
Yeah.
Not to coin the film, but there's so many things that could happen between a best and a worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And it's been incredibly helpful in just about everything I do. Because I do encounter really challenging situations. When I look at the responsibilities and stuff I've got on in my life now, way worse than what it was in the past. But I'm able to deal with it because I don't get carried away with these extreme swings of emotion. When I've got a problem, I literally get myself in the moment, think it through, and work out what I've got to do.
Do you engage others in that process?
Can do, yeah. If I need input from, not so much from a psychological point of view, more from a, right, we've got to get to there. I don't quite know how to do that. Who do I know who can? Because we've got all sorts of specialists and things.
Is there a danger, though, that you try and do too much yourself and you end up back in the downward spiral, if I can put it like that? So, in some ways, if you've got a problem, spread it, problem shared, problem halved,
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, I think I'm quite good now at the work-life balance. I'm probably been a workaholic, and I am at times. I know the triggers, so I sense when, if I'm not having a great time, which is quite rare now, which is good.
It's good, that is good.
And I do something about it. But one thing I said, all the stuff I learned we put into a sort of presentation, so one was around my top tips around well-being, and some of them are cognitive behavior therapy linked, others are more just sort of basic stuff, and then some resilient stuff. But one of the things I say is in the day, when Fred Goodwin was sort of RBS CEO, wanted to take over the world, everything was 150%, this sort of mentality, and you hear people say we've got to be 110% on this, and I just say that's ridiculous. And I say,
would you say that to yourself?
I don't need to now, but I say.
But you would then.
Yeah, I've got to really push myself.
Would you say it to anybody else?
So what I say to people is, look, you can't do more than 100%. It's impossible. So, yeah, I know it's a sort of figure of speech, but it's a really dangerous figure of speech.
Mm.
You cannot do more than 100. If you're at 100, you're going to fail at some point because you cannot sustain that. So I say to people, I work at a mindset of 70-75 at all times, because when the proverbial sometimes hits the fan, if you're 100, you've got nowhere to go. So always, psychologically, I've always got capacity to take stuff on. Probably the thing where I've at times suffer is taking on too much, but I'm kind of aware of it. I'm very aware of my own feelings. But Victoria, jump forward a bit, but your question about thinking, but it's the thinking errors that really screw people up. And if you can break the thinking errors, so I talked about black and white and grey.
Yeah.
There's I remember hearing a guy from Deloitte who was a very good speaker on something, and a really profound statement was, thoughts aren't facts. They're in your head. They're not factual. So they're not real. So all of the thinking, and I thought for years my mind plays tricks on you.
Yeah.
And the other thing, and one of the things that Blake Stapley told me, which is profound, is most things people worry about don't happen. And he asked me the question, how many things that you really worry about actually come to reality? And he quoted, it was a German university study I've conducted with about 10,000 people, and it was 6% of what people actually worried about came to reality.
Yeah. So what a waste of energy.
Exactly. And that's the whole thing about, and he asked me about worry. So, Miles, what is worrying? And I said, well, it's sort of, and we concluded, it's filling your head full of rubbish and no output. That's why. So code red is worry, whereas structured black and white and end up into a grey is sensible because you're thinking it through. And that's why people are so tired when they're anxious or have depression, because they're just ruminating the whole time and not.
Yeah, sometimes though, it's very, very, very difficult to get those thoughts out of your head.
Oh, 100% agree with you.
You know, and no matter how much you talk to yourself, you still can't. Because it happens to me a lot.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I will remember a tiny, unbelievably small fact from 30 years ago, and it'll give me a whoosh of whatever.
Do you kill it off?
Or? I do now. Yeah, I do. I know.
I know what you mean.
Just move on. Because before, a few years back maybe, it would have stuck with me for a week. And I'm not thinking about anything else. And I'm obsessed and absorbed. And my interaction with anybody else is broadly zero at that point.
But he also talked, so negative automatic thoughts, NATs is what they call them. Things that just, so everyone has really mad thoughts sometimes. And stuff pops in your head and you think you're crazy, but it's so normal.
I know it is normal.
But what he gave a really good analogy. He said, I'm going to talk to you about train spotting at Clapham Junction. Ooh, blow, what's that about? And he said, right, train's going. So he said, what do train spotters never do at Clapham Junction?
Spot a train.
Oh, they spot. They never get on a train. They're always there with their little cameras and notebooks and everything. They never get on the train. He said, right, negative automatic thoughts are going in and out of Clapham Junction all day, right? You get on one of the trains, and then it stops. And then, oh, it's broken down. Another train comes back behind it. It's stuck. Oh, do I get on off? Another one then backs up behind it. So he said, when you've got an anxiety disorder and you've got all these things coming into your head and you've got on them and you're engaging with them, rather than just looking at it and going all the way through.
Yeah.
He said, that's why, and when I went back to work, I still had all this stuff in my head. And the last time I was off, I took 3 months, it's a long time, wanted to go back. My brother stepped in. He was really helpful. Was having that support network that I built.
Yeah.
He said, you're not going back for another month. If you're feel you're ready to go back now, you're not doing it for another month. And I insist on that. Best bit of advice I ever had, because the head was really clear. So rather than, I think I've got to go back, I was a month later almost gagging to go back. But that extra month, I did loads of fitness and
I was going to ask stuff. You, what were the other things
reading,
you did?
Reading, fitness, just keeping yourself occupied, but functioning, building your confidence back up. Because he said to me, you know, another one of my things is don't beat yourself up. I mean, we are terrible at beating ourselves up.
Yeah, we are.
So good boss, bad boss. Who's your best ever boss been? Really encouraging, setting you realistic goals, supporting you. Who's your bad boss? Tries to trip you up, gives you a hard time, criticises yourself.
Yeah.
What boss are you to yourself?
Nothing is good enough. Yeah.
What are you to yourself?
Well, you're the latter, aren't you?
Exactly. So those sorts of things. So there was a lot of mindset changes that I really took on board. And then going back to your point, you know, if you do it and give it up by the 15th of January, you go back. Whereas I totally changed what I did. And because Blake gave me loads of homework, so I was drilling it in. I thought, well, I'm done if I don't do this. And
so have you done, you know, there's the three sort of things about sleep, obviously, which was a problem for you, and fitness and eating.
All of those. Well, I was a dietitian, so that was quite helpful.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, no, it was. So that when I was off, you know, good diet, got sleep. And I got my sleep back quite quickly.
Did you?
That's, yeah, I've always been good sleeper, actually. But so, which is why it was so difficult at the time because suddenly you can't sleep. I mean, it was horrendous. I never forget it.
Yeah, we had a guy on here a little while ago, and he talked about spoon theory, which wasn't his actually. It was he pinched it from somewhere else. Right. So I'm going to pinch it now. But it basically says you know when you wake up in the morning, you've got a certain number of spoons, which is effectively the energy you've got for the day.
Okay.
And then you spend it, right? So you use your spoons doing stuff. And if you've run out by 6 o'clock on your allocation for the day, what you do is you borrow it from tomorrow.
Right, okay.
Yeah? And then you get up in the morning and you've got...
So it's like a finite amount of energy, isn't it?
You've got, you know, 6 spoons, or we've got 50 in a day, you've got 15 less than you started with the day before. And the same thing happens again. And funnily enough, you run out of spoons at some point, and that's when your energy disappears. And what's happened to you and what happened to me, you just can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. So the sleep, eat, and what was the other? Exercise.
Yeah. Just, exercise, so important.
Yeah, those three things helps you get your spoons back and gives you time to think and process the stuff like you're saying.
Now, it was interesting because, I mean, the upshot of everything was when I got back to work, phased in, they kept an eye on me, and it worked. And I, you know, learned all
Did they all know at that point?
Yeah, they did. So the second time when I went back, I remember going to have a coffee with a mate. They all knew the first time.
Did they?
So that's interesting, because no one ever said anything to me, but that's interesting. I got, work were fantastic. They really were supportive. They welcomed me back with open arms. There was no, because there was this, if you're off a mental illness, you know, you're not really ill sort of thing.
Yeah, I know. None of that pisses me off.
And so I started performing really well. I was, became really successful, or got back to where I was, and some. Because I had all this time to do stuff because I wasn't worrying about stuff. But I then started getting all these taps on the shoulders from people for a coffee, and you know what it's about. And it was incredible.
How wonderful is that?
Yeah, it was really nice. And people I knew really well, people you would never dream of.
Yeah, yeah.
And
like that, they probably didn't dream of you that way either.
Exactly. Curse of the strong.
Yeah.
What surprised me was they couldn't talk to their line manager because fear of... Oh my God.
Yep.
Or they didn't know how to handle it. They didn't know about any of the resources. RBS and now NatWest had fantastic resources, really good employee assistant program provider, all these guides, Moments That Matter guides about stuff that goes on in life that happens to each and every one of us, what to do, loads of stuff. No one really knew about it. And we'd had a really bad staff survey, a lot of stress in the business, a lot of anxiety, engagement was really low. We got a new CEO at the time, a guy called Peter Flavel that came in, fantastic guy. And he was responsible for really getting everyone engaged. He was a brilliant communicator, very energetic, and a super nice, competent bloke. And we had a diversity inclusion committee, and they put a thing called lifestyle on there. It wasn't quite D&I. They didn't quite know what to do with it. And when I came back, I took on a mentor who was the LGBT guy, really good bloke. And I told him my story. He said, Miles, you've got to come to the D&I meeting and say what you've just told me. This was all around being ill, then getting better, then helping people. So to cut a long story short, I ended up being responsible to devise and implement a wellbeing strategy. A guy called Mike Hayworth heard about it and came and had a chat with me, and he said, I'd really like to get involved, because I've had people come up to me who aren't in my team, they're in a different team, but because I'm quite an empathetic guy who cares about this sort of stuff, they found me easy to talk to. But it's unbelievable how people can't talk about this at work.
Well, if you think 1 in 4, or whatever the ratio is, doesn't matter, it's significant. Yeah. And nobody knows who the 1 in 4 is. Nobody is prepared to talk about it through the stigma, the shame, or the guilt, or whatever it is, or the fear of...
So this is 2012, 13,
oh, okay.
So a long time ago.
It is.
And so we basically spent about nine months
Had you stopped your previous responsibilities?
No. Side of desk. And I was busy, but I had these new superpowers. So we really took our time, because I thought, if you raise this subject, you've got to have something for people.
Yeah.
You can't just get out there and there's no support. And we don't quite know what we want to do yet. But we thought, we don't want to reinvent the wheel, because look at all these great resources that no one knows about. let's see what other companies are doing.
Inside the organisation?
In and outside. So we had various health providers inside. So we talked to them. We talked to HR. We talked to the board. And we went to, there was a Deutsche Bank, Lloyds, Barclays, the This Is Me campaign that the city did, Lord Mayor's office, which was fantastic, and just absorbed stuff. And we basically came up initially with a two-pronged strategy, which was physical and mental.
Yep.
So Nuffield Know Your Numbers health check for everyone. And that was groundbreaking because, you know, cash on the table. People were referred, went straight to their GP. You know, they were high cholesterol and changed their diets. And, you know, it was really great. There was certain things that everyone could get involved in.
Like, was that like a physical MOT, though?
Physical MOT, yeah, very much so.
Okay.
There were things, so we created a yoga class, we did a running club. So you just got it out there, you know, but proof is in the pudding. Go and get yourself checked out for Know Your Numbers. And then at the same time, what we learned was that the most influential people in an organisation are your line managers. They are the most stressed people because they, if you think of it, they get it from above and get it from below.
The higher up you go, the worse it gets.
But you get it from above and below and they're squeezed. And they're responsible for other people. So if they're not right, the team aren't going to be right. But we didn't want to have a go at them. We said to the board, because we presented what we wanted to do to the board. And the first thing we said is, we need you behind us. Because if the tone at the top isn't right, it's not going to happen. And I remember going into the room, we had literally a 5-minute presentation to our board. And Mike had a coach and he said, get your story in. And I went in and said, look, 1 in 4 people have a mental health disorder. Look around the room, a couple of flickering eyes, thought, right, okay, this is what happened to me. And we left that room about 1 hour and 10 minutes later.
Wow.
And they talked about it for about another hour afterwards. So it totally ruined their board meeting, but they just thought,
but it shows you how important it is.
Yeah, and they got it. They really got it. So that was, you know, getting tone from the top and engagement, then having staff run initiatives, because if you get passionate people that want to be involved for the right reasons, not just to tick a box on D&I, but actually care about these sorts of things, the line manager was essential. So what I said to them is, look, we've devised some training. I want an hour with every single line manager in the bank. And they agreed. And we did about 50 presentations all around the country, out to Jersey, where we just told the stories and then delivered a load of tips and then said, these are the things to look for on your team. Here's a load of resource that is there already. How well do you know your teams? You know where they are on the performance grid. Do you know where they are on their mental health grid?
Did you get any resistance?
None. So really? We had 2 negative comments over everything. And one was said, oh, I've got a few people in my team. I think they're just, and I said, you know, like,
I think they're skivers.
I said, let me tell you from personal experience, the last place you want to be is at home with a mental health disorder.
Yeah.
And I heard that from someone else quite senior at another organisation that remain nameless, said the same thing, and I put him straight on it, and they were brilliant, you know, and it turned around.
But conversely, you see, when I was having a particularly bad period, the thought of going to a yoga class at work with my colleagues would have been absolutely no-go area.
Well, that was just that was a more of a fitness thing, and people with bad backs, and so it wasn't.
No, sorry, but the point I'm making is that to do a group exercise for mental well-being when you're feeling shit in the first place.
Oh, the yoga wasn't about.
No, I probably used the wrong example, but just to doing things together, right, as a group of work colleagues when you're going through a mental health position is not the right thing to do. But there are other things that you can do, presumably.
So what we did. So the line manager training went down really well. The only other negative comment was, oh yeah, we always have things like this. It'll all wash out. So me and Mike sort of devised a strap line. It's not for Christmas and there's no downside. So as long as you've researched it, you know, there's other things. It has to be authentic. This isn't ticking a box. It has to become, going back to your point,
yeah,
people give things up on the 15th of January. It had to become a way of being and a DNA within our company, and it did become that. Because all the engagement scores and the well-being scores went up substantially and have remained very high.
I'm sorry to interrupt again, because we'll come back to your story. It's really fascinating. But for me, it's about board of directors behavior, actually, because that's where ultimately I got to as CFO of Superdry, right? And you're not dealing with the executives and the line managers and the business itself. Mm. You're dealing with people who really couldn't give a toss about that, actually. Mm. They're much more interested in looking after minority shareholders, which is their corporate governance role, and driving profits and so on. So did you find that, if I could put it to the PLC board, rather than the board of, say, Coutts, if they're, assuming there's a distinction, did you get the same sort of buy-in and behaviour from that level as well?
Absolutely. It was interesting. So Deloitte did a lot of studies on, so board of directors, return on capital, that's a big thing. Return on investment.
Ultimately, it's only that.
So they all the research has said that for every pound you spend on wellbeing, it's about an £11 return. So no-brainer. So you, when we pitched to the board, we showed them that research and said, look, this... But ultimately, what I would say to any board of any company, if your staff are your most valuable asset, which at the end of the day they are, we've all got stakeholders, you know, but ultimately, if your staff feel good about themselves, feel empowered, feel capable, and are happy in the workplace, they are going to perform the best. If they're not, they're not going to get the best results. And if they're not, you have a decision, you know, do you crack the whip or you do get to the heart of the problem? That's like sensible business management. If there's a problem, what are we going to do about it? And that was very much the approach that Coutts took, because we had had a really low staff survey. I thought, we've got to do something about this. We don't quite know what to do. And it was very fortunate that, I guess, myself and Mike picked it up. And then, but we got really good support. And they were, you know, I said, can you go? So one of the things we did was launched a wellbeing hub. And I got various staff members. I put the word out and said, look, anyone's got a story they want to share, because personal disclosure does move the dial.
I think I saw yours, actually.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, that might have been the This Is Me.
Yeah, I don't know what it was, but I definitely saw it.
But we got, so half the board did one. One talked about, well, you know, one had cancer, one had had anxiety, one had imposter syndrome when he came on the board. And we had a whole load of things. So people thought, wow, Mark, well, this is fantastic. Really good. You know, get it out there, because it was for the right reasons. And, you know, you as soon as you disturb, because the rush of emails, as it was going back, when I launched 100 emails, but we had something for them, and that was really important. And it went on to expand. So roll forward, NatWest, they had all these resources. They formed a global committee. They got input from all different jurisdictions and expanded it out. And it's brilliant. I mean, they've won awards. I mean, me and Mike, the Reba Award, which was the blue ribbon one, was amazing, and that was the first thing. We weren't doing it for that.
No.
But it that then got, ooh, group. So they adopted a lot of what we did. But they were brilliant all the way through. But it didn't, you know, this wasn't high monetary things. It was
No, it's
changing
not.
Behaviour,
it's not.
And changing as you the say, psyche.
The business case is compelling. Mm. Do you think it was important that you'd had your own issue with mental health in order to be able to do this?
I think so. Yeah. I think it helped. Because you could, when you talk from your own experience and you've been through a journey, it was more the journey rather. It was never about me. It was always hitting a wall, following something, getting better. That was the message. Capture it early. The whole purpose of it.
Yeah.
Capture it.
It's about
it
prevention, isn't it?
Every time.
Yeah.
Mike, so the other guy that did it with me, he was, we worked really well as a double act, but his story was someone approached him that didn't feel confident to speak to their own manager, and that really surprised him. And he said, we've got to do something. So we both told slightly different stories. So Mike could have done it on his own, but I think if you've had someone that's come out the other end, isn't showboating and is just keeping it very authentic. Well,
exactly, that's the word.
That carried huge weight.
How do you deal with people who can't talk to their line manager, are ashamed about what they feel, and if they know that if they go and see X person, the rumour mill will start, and they'll say, oh God, he's just gone off to his psychotherapy course or something, or whatever. How do you deal with those sorts of people who really don't want anybody else to know, at that stage?
It's very difficult. So what we did, one of the outputs of the sort of strategy we did, was we set up an ambassador network, informal group of people who really cared about this. It wasn't, again, CV fillers, so people that had a genuine interest. And me and Mike interviewed every single person that wanted to do it and asked them why, and wanted to just make sure that it was a real authentic thing. So there was an anonymous email box that came in that myself and Mike monitored, and if someone reached out for help, we'd make contact with them, we'd check with them, and we'd try and marry them up with someone. Often me and Mike helped
doing them. It themselves, yeah.
Some we wouldn't have heard from. There's only so much you can do. I had a couple of people that would, it was, I'll just never forget it. They were in such a state, crying, and one of the guys wet himself on the way in on the train. He just had such bad anxiety. I know this guy. And he is turned around and he's doing fantastically well. But it just shows you, I always say to people, no matter how bad it looks, everyone, we are superhuman, that what people can put up with, if you look at all the stuff going on in the world and how you know, people can be buried in rubble for 2 weeks come out. So people are incredibly resilient.
Yeah.
And it's just trying to instill a tiny bit of belief that they can get themselves up, but not to feel ashamed, not to feel embarrassed. So you just throw empathy.
Warmth.
Don't tell them what to do. Just the fact that they've come and talked to someone is so important. And it's you know, it's like, you know, it's a problem shared is a weight off your shoulder.
Yeah.
And we had to give, you know, training to the ambassadors, because they said, look, this is going to get heavy in parts. But the only, we always kept it confidential unless there was, we thought there was a risk to life. And we stuck with that.
No, but that's, yeah. That's
yeah. And we had people in. So Johnny Benjamin and Neil Laybourne came in, the man on the bridge story. That was a groundbreaker for us. We had, so when we got it going, we thought, right, we need some big impact things. We had over 500 people, either in person or on the call. We did a staff event a client event, where we had MQ, who are like a mental health research, and my old university, Cardiff, they've got a brilliant neuro department where they're doing all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff, and we got a couple of the professors to come. Because I've been at one of the alumni event and got to know the vice chancellor.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it was really interesting.
Hey, with that, we can cut this bit out.
Yeah,
Yasmin, I'll come and do a talk for you as well if you want.
Okay.
Because I do that.
Oh right.
As part of my whatever I do.
Yeah.
So I'd be more than happy to come and chat to
council. Oh, I'll mention
whoever.
It because I've handed on.
Oh right, okay.
But you know, I did it for 4 years because it's a massive. It became huge. And their whole team sort of took over. So there's someone now in NatWest, that's all they do.
I would love to chat to them,
to
be honest.
But Janet Johnson and Mark Farrell run it now, and they're brilliant. I handed over a guy called Alan Marshall, who I used to work with at Lloyd's, and he, you know, they went through the mill. The two people now that do it haven't been through the mill, but they know people that have.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's you know, we did the Green Ribbon campaign. The This Is Me video we did. So This Is Me is where you... five people in a company talk about their story, and we got it professionally filmed. It started off in black and white, and it went colour at the end, and it was amazing.
That's quite impactful.
But we put it on Coutts.com, which is, so when we have investment videos and webinars, we put them on there. It's the most watched video ever to have gone on our client website.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, what a bloody brilliant idea.
And
and the black and white colour, that just...
I got really emotional when I watched it.
To be honest, I am a little bit now, because that just typifies the journey that people go, because you're living in the black and white world, which is where we started. Yeah.
I went totally grey.
Yeah.
You know, the John Major thing in there. Yeah. I was like that for about a year.
Miles, look, this has been fantastic. We haven't spoken about the entrepreneurs that you deal with, because I just think they are not a law unto themselves. They are a group of people unto themselves. Mm. You know, the CEO and founder of Superdry is an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And they are difficult characters, but that's because they're entrepreneurs. Mm. That's what makes them. Mm. But the downside of all of that is that they are under such immense pressure, you know, for looking after the company, looking after the people that work there, trying to make a success. Everything's a weight on their shoulders. So, I mean, how do you deal with those people?
Oh, I love it. I mean, look, people are, at the end of the day, they're all individuals. And for me, I think the heart of any relationship is being able to talk to people on the level And the more they share about their situation, because, yeah, I guess if we're lending the money, we want to know it's going to be repaid. So understanding their business and, you know, the difficulties. What I've seen, what was amazing during the whole global financial crisis is the ability of entrepreneurs to sort of pivot and chop and change really quickly. Yeah. So they are, I mean, I have so much admiration. They get really bad press sometimes. You know, all these capital producers, but they employ thousands of people.
I say they help people. They take the risks.
The philanthropy that goes on the quiet. We're big into that when people make more
How
money.
How do they deal with a boring banker?
We're not boring. you become a confidant.
Do you dress up? Huh? Do you get your jeans on and your
No, I did have something really funny though. When after COVID, a new client I'd inherited, he said, come and have a coffee at my club. And it was, I don't know, his home house or something like that. And I turned up in a suit and a tie. And he was like, he took a photo and put it on Twitter. He said, I haven't seen a tie for so long. It made me laugh. It really did.
Yeah, but, excellent. It's just, I'm asking a lot of people this question. And I've thought about whether I should ask it at the beginning and let you have a think about it. But then I thought, no, I'm not going to do that because it might, you'll be thinking about it all the way through. So the question is, at board level, right, senior level, what is the one thing that you'd like to do or have happen that would help the mental health agenda?
It has to be backed from the top. Whatever you do, they have to be on board. They have to be seen to be supporting it. If they can and they've got their own story, tell it.
Perfect.
It's the stories that engage people. And so what we found when we were with all the line managers, because it's an hour, it's a long time, and they're all really busy, we started with the story, and you could hear a pin drop in every single session, and they were engaged. And afterwards, I remember one guy said, I would have run a mile from this, but it's absolutely my duty to make sure my team are safe and secure, if that makes sense.
It does.
So from a board level, it's such a hard gig. You know, there's so much public scrutiny. But ultimately, if you get a really good strategy in place, there is no downside. But, as I said, it's not for Christmas. It's got to become part of your DNA.
Yeah.
And if it does, you've just got such a better engaged workforce. We've had graduates joining us because they've seen the mental health strategy.
Yeah, you see, I think the young are being very canny, aren't they? Because they're looking at organisations and thinking, well, okay, that might be a nice-looking company from the outside, but what's it really like? Yeah. Do they look after their people?
Yeah.
Because, I have this fear of the one thing, if I was going to do this, and I call this the plastic bag moment, right, which is the, you remember plastic bags? And they government introduced a 10p levy. Disappeared overnight. So really simple intervention and it instantly changed the world or the country. My plastic bag moment would be to get a chairman or a CEO of a FTSE 100 PLC to come out and tell their story like you've just said. Because what it does is it gives permission then to everybody else in the organisation and it creates a psychologically safe environment that they feel free to be able to do it.
So Antonio Horto, sorry,
he is such a good example.
Top 300 people in Lloyds Bank all went on a week-long retreat where they learned about mental health.
I know. Those things are rare.
Yeah.
You know? And as you go down into small, medium enterprises as well, it gets
It is harder, particularly when you're so dependent on people.
Yeah.
But I think just having that, it's interesting because we've spoken really widely and companies were, in early on, was so interested, this can happen, the awards group that we helped sort of, we had one of their ceremonies at our place, that, the mental health in the workplace. It was, you're hearing sports stars and everyone.
Yeah, actors,
but
actresses,
you weren't
celebs.
Really, and it's a really good, interesting thing that Blake said. He said, if you think of a professional cricketer, psychologist, physical trainer, dietitian, so they've got this whole support team. And he said, look at a cricket pitch. It's 22 yards. The balls are practically the same. The bats are the same. And look at the change they've had in their support. Look at business.
I know.
There's no comparison to 50 years ago to now.
Yeah.
Unbelievable amounts of change, pressure and everything else. do the board. I mean, some, you know, the really smart boards will have.
Yeah.
There'll be a psychologist. There'll be someone, you know, a doctor on site or whatever. And there's been nothing.
I know. But in my experience, and it was a little while ago now, right, the CEO, Julian, and me, 8 non-execs, and it was a bloody grilling. I mean, it was, they were throwing grenades. They were bullying you. The behaviour was appalling. You know, why does it doesn't have to be like that. In fact, it's completely counterproductive.
No, we're really good at calling out. I mean, there isn't a lot of bad behavior. You've got to call it out.
Yeah.
You know, someone's been, you know, and there's a way of doing it.
There is, but you need to have created that psychologically safe environment where actually it's okay to call it out. And the person who's being called out reflects on what they've done and what their behavior is.
But I've only ever had great support. I must admit, you know, I take my hat off to how they managed my situation. And, you know, part of it was... calling, you know, to do all of this was a bit of a calling, because I met a number of people that kind of do similar things, and they've all either had something happen to them or someone they're close to them.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I do this.
And it's really, you know, I think it's a really good thing to do.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I mean, admiration and awe of what you're doing, and the fact that you've had such good results and feedback, and and it's working well, and you're in a better place, is a testament to all the stuff that's going
thank
on.
You.
So, thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for coming on. Just Not Good Enough. We've overrun, God's sake, but really, really interesting.
Yeah,
and
thank you for
opening up and being so honest about your circumstances.
Pleasure. Really
Cheers,
nice
Miles.
To meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chaz.
Bye.